The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Woman's Gateless Gate, Bodhidharma and Peace of Mind. The main case. Bodhidharma sat in Zazen facing the wall. The second ancestor had been standing in the snow, cut off his arm, and said, "Your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, my teacher, please give it peace." Bodhidharma said, "Bring the mind to me, and I'll set it at rest." The second ancestor said, "I have searched for this mind, and it is finally unattainable." Bodhidharma said, "I have thoroughly set it at rest for you." The commentary. The broken-toothed old foreigner proudly came over, 100,000 miles across the sea. This was as if he were raising waves where there was no wind. Towards this end, Bodhidharma could only enlighten one disciple. Shansaro does not know even four characters. The poem. Coming from the west and directly pointing, this great affair was caused by the transmission. The troublemaker who created a stir in Zen circles is, after all, you. So this is a very well-known koan, and deservedly so, I think, in the koan literature. And koans are paths of inquiry. The Buddha said that calming the mind and insight into self-nature, into the nature of things, is ultimately liberating. And so then the question is, how within our meditation is there inquiry? An inquiry that is not just reflective or contemplative, is not more thinking, not bringing more views, more ideas, more concepts, but is actually piercing through all of those and helping us to see into the inner workings of things. And so the koan is taken up in a meditation, in one's meditation, with the very specific intention to not think about it. It's got words, the words have meaning, there's a situation going on here. It looks very much like a story. Very often when, you know, I hear talks by other teachers and read writings by the teachers who may not have actually gone through formal koan training, who refer to koans, use koans in their teachings in ways that can make sense, there can be helpful, drawing on stories to illuminate and inspire and point to different aspects of religious practice, Buddhist practice, in ways that all religions do. You know, teaching stories is one of the very sort of oldest and ongoing teaching tools in a spiritual path. Every religion has them. But that's not what these are. They can be that. I mean, this is definitely a story going on here. But the purpose of the koan is not ultimately to sort of be a parable or a metaphor or, you know, sort of be interpreted in some way that does actually help. The koan, rather, is really trying to bring the meditator, the student, to the ground of being. That's why it's brought into their meditation practice. That's why to work with the koan, they have to go beyond a conceptualization of the koan. That's why every koan has an inquiry. Sometimes that inquiry is made explicit, as it is in this one, sometimes it's not. The student has to find what is the inquiry, what is the questions that's being asked, what is it that I want to understand or resolve through this particular form of training. Bodhidharma is, in the Zen tradition, considered the first ancestor of Zen. He was an Indian master who came to China. There's a lot of sort of historical speculation about who was this person. There are records that come from somebody named Bodhidharma. It's not utterly verifiable, all of it, but in a way that doesn't matter so much in terms of practicing, because we're not here as historians, but rather here as practitioners. And so it's the sort of the spirit or the teaching or the message, you might say, that comes along with this that is important. Bodhidharma, it's said, sort of characterized Zen as a special transmission. This great affair was caused by the transmission from teacher to disciple. That's how Buddhism has come down to us. The Buddha basically empowered some of his disciples as teachers, and then they taught, and then that transmission, that empowerment has come down over the ages. But Bodhidharma said it's a special transmission outside of sutras. It can't be given through a sutra. It doesn't rely on words and letters, right? It can't be conveyed ultimately in words and meaning. Rather, it's a direct pointing to the mind and the realization of enlightenment, which raises the question of what is mind? Why does Buddhism direct so many of its teachings, so many of its inquiries, so much emphasis on not just mind and all that it is, which it does, but the nature of mind? And so Buddhism sometimes is, we can think of Buddhism as sort of the essential question being asked is, what is the nature of the self? This is no different from the question is, what is the nature of mind? Same question. And that question arises out of the desire, the question of how can I be free and unhindered in this world? Not only how can I be unhindered, but how can I be unhindering? How can I not hinder you? How can I be at peace, and how can I bring mind, a mind of peace, into the world? The Buddha realized that to bring peace into the world, we have to set the mind at peace. To set the mind at peace, the Buddha said, we have to liberate the mind from its lack of peacefulness. We have to see into its nature. To see into the nature of mind is Zazen. So this story, the koan itself, is sort of based in a larger story. So Bodhidharma, being this first ancestor, it said he came to China from India, had a very important encounter with the Emperor Wu at that time, who was an historical figure, which we won't get into today for lack of time, but is worth getting into. And then he went to sit at Shaolin Monastery in a cave for quite a number of years, facing the wall. So when we turn and face the wall, when we sit in Zazen, in a sense that's echoing this practice of Bodhidharma, facing the wall. What is that wall? So here Bodhidharma is sitting, and a monk named Hueka comes and wants to study with him, wants to be his disciple. And so the story is that he came in December and sat outside day and night asking for the teachings. Now, a teacher, in receiving transmission, one of the vows they take and make, one of their commitments, is to do all that they can to transmit the Dharma, to ensure that the Dharma continues. And within that is a much larger vow, is to teach, to offer the Dharma to anyone who asks. And so here Bodhidharma is being asked by Hueka, desperately wants to study with him, and Bodhidharma just sits facing the wall, pays him no mind, gives him no attention. And it's said that Hueka just stood there, asking for the teachings, begging to enter, and Bodhidharma ignored him, and then he stood all through the night, during which it snowed, and the snow came up to his knees, and finally, in the commentary, it says Bodhidharma had pity on him and said, you've been standing in the snow for a long time. What are you seeking? And Weka, through bitter tears, said, I beseech you, O Master, with your compassion, pray open your gate of the Dharma and save all sentient beings. Save the sentient beings. Teach me. And Bodhidharma said, the incomparable truth of the Buddhas can only be attained by great striving, practicing what cannot be practiced, bearing the unbearable. How can you, with your little virtue, little wisdom, and with your easy and self-conceited mind, dare to aspire to this true teaching? It is only so much labor lost. And it's kind of interesting that when the Buddha, after his enlightenment, based in his own teachings, in his own accounting, said that he really deliberated and thought he probably shouldn't teach, because as he looked out and sort of surveyed the landscape of humanity, he said, people are just too enamored to cherish their attachments. They're not going to be interested in this. He said, it's just going to be wearisome for me. Too much labor lost. But then an appeal was made on the behalf of those human beings, those sentient beings who could hear, who did want to know. And so he began his teaching. So here, Bodhidharma, in a sense, echoes that. It would only be so much labor lost. And so hearing that, Weka took out a knife, cut off his arm, and made an offering to Bodhidharma as a gesture of how deep his sincerity was. Now, this is not something to try at home, folks. It's clear, it's made clear in the commentaries, this is not an historical fact. It's not something to be taken in that way. But rather as an expression for all of us of what is it, how important, in a sense, is our life to us? How important is a mind at peace to us? How important is to be unhindered and unhindering to us? How important is everybody else, in a sense, to us in this great earth? And what are we willing to relinquish? Because if we just keep doing everything that we've been doing, Weka knew that if he just kept doing everything he'd been doing, he would continue to be not at peace. Something needed to happen, something different. He was asking for the teachings, but he already knew he would need to relinquish something, and so he started with his arm. And so in that way, it asks every student to reflect on that. What do I most cherish? And in letting go of that, in relinquishing, what am I relinquishing? It's our attachment. Dada Roshi used to say, when we let go of everything, when you let go of everything, what remains? And then he would answer, everything. Everything remains. What's been relinquished is the attachment to it. And so seeing this arm presented to him, Bodhidharma realized that he was a vessel of the Dharma. And he said, when people first seek after the truth, they'll go to great ends for the sake of the Dharma. I see that you are deeply sincere in your seeking. And then Weka says, is it possible to listen to the Buddha Dharma? Can I hear you teach the Dharma? And Bodhidharma said, the Buddha Dharma cannot be attained by following others. You can't follow me, in a sense. That is, you have to see into it yourself. And he said, what are you seeking? And Weka said, my mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, please, give it peace. And so Bodhidharma said, bring that mind to me. Bring the mind that is not at peace to me, and I will set it at rest for you. And so this example, and for the student who's sitting with this koan, you have to enter into it, which means you have to let go of your idea of now and me and this and reality and opinions and everything and enter into it completely in your mind. Make it real. And to be that very person, asking for the teaching, seeking, the mind not at peace. And for the student who understands that, this can be an incredibly powerful koan, because it is speaking directly to what the student already is experiencing, already knows, and has been given a voice and a sense of direction and an invitation. Bring that mind to me. So that's what the student needs to do. Bring that mind. Bring that mind to their teacher, and it will be set at rest. And that sense of great determination, of perseverance. You know, in Buddhism's coming to the West, and in our time of technology and communication and media, the Buddha Dharma is, in terms of teachings, is more easily accessible than ever in the history of the world. I mean, we're in a situation that Buddhism has never been in, ever. You had to travel, you had to go to a place where teachings were being offered in person by a teacher. And that meant traveling. You couldn't get on a plane, you couldn't grab a bus, you had to walk. It was long, it was hard, it was dangerous. And so, in a way, it's wonderful that the Dharma is so much more accessible to us. And think about the mind of that person, that seeker, who has to go through so much to finally be able to be in the presence of a teacher and ask for the teachings. Right? That mind has been ripened. It's in a very particular place. Right? And so, in a sense, we need to find that within ourselves if we want to really encounter this deeply. And it's recognizing, I mean, this, we're concluding an introductory retreat, it's recognizing that people come to the Dharma, those of you who have come here this weekend, those of you here today, people come here for all kinds of reasons, you know. For some people, this is just a meditation hall. They just want a place where they can sit. Some people are drawn by liturgy. Some people are looking for a community. When we practice together, we all sit, we all do liturgy, so everybody who trains here has to, you know, jump into all of those different things. But that doesn't mean everybody is drawn to each of those different forms of practice in the same way. It doesn't mean that everybody has that degree of hunger, of spiritual yearning, we might say desperation, what Dr. Roshi called the spiritual imperative. We may not have that at the beginning of our searching, but that may develop. That may never be what it is for us. And to whatever degree we encounter the Dharma, that's probably going to be a good thing. It's going to help. This story is really directed towards that deepest searching that is available to everybody. And people's, you know, the way different people encounter the Dharma and practice can also not just have to do with internal conditions, but external. Your life, your circumstances, your situation, you know, the demands on your life, your responsibilities, because this does take some time. I was reading writing by St. Teresa of Avila, one of the great Catholic mystics of the 16th century. She was a Carmelite nun who was made a saint later, and was just a very deep mystic, spiritual person. And then she's writing to her sister nuns, and she says, once we have detached ourselves from the world, once we have let go, in a sense coming here, you know, at least externally, you have detached yourself from the world, and from our kinfolk, our family, and are here together in the conditions already described, it must look as if we have done everything and there's nothing left with which we have to contend. But, oh, my sisters, do not feel secure and fall asleep, or you will be like a person who goes to bed quite peacefully after bolting all the doors for fear of thieves when the thief is already in the house. And you know there is no worse thief than the one who lives in your own house. We ourselves are always the same, unless we take great care. And each of us looks well to it that we renounce, let go of our self-will, our willfulness, right? Our attachments, our desires, which is the most important business of all. There will be many things to deprive us of the holy freedom of spirits which our souls seek. And she says, it will be of great help towards this if we keep constantly in our thoughts the vanity, in a sense, the clinging, the self-grasping of all things, and the rapidity with which they pass away. All things are impermanent. So that we may withdraw our affections from those things which are so trivial, let go of what is not so important, and turn our attention to those things that never come to an end. In Buddhism, we call that the unconditioned truth of all things. But it remains for us to become free or detached from our own selves. And it is a hard thing to withdraw from ourselves because we are so very close to ourselves and love ourselves so very dearly. And you know, the Buddha said this. He said, we cherish ourselves most dearly, but he said it in a positive way, not in the sense that we should therefore attach and cling to ourselves, but rather, in a sense, we become, in a sense, a significant motivation to alleviate our suffering because we're the ones who experience it. We feel that most keenly. And then she says, it's here that true humility can enter. For this virtue and that of detachment from the self, letting go of the self, I think always go together. They are like two sisters who are inseparable. These are not the kinfolk whom I counsel you to avoid. No, you must embrace them and love them and never be seen without them. That is humility and relinquishing our attachments to the self. So isn't it nice to see how a very deep practitioner, a mystic practitioner, whose life was really dedicated to not just, you know, the ideas and the concepts of her tradition, but wanted to encounter it at the deepest level, and did, of a very different tradition, right? And the commonality in what she has to say of what is necessary, what she encounters. Of course, she presents it in a different language, right? Because her life is centered and she is seeking God. We're seeking Buddha nature, right? And those are not necessarily the same. But the path and towards that ultimate, right? That ultimate which will set our minds at peace, we see so many similarities. And so here, Hueka says, my mind is not yet at peace. And I love that it includes the word yet. Not yet at peace. So even in his torment, in his hunger, in his desperation, it speaks of a kind of confidence. Not yet. As though there's a faith that he will set his mind at peace. And I think this koan is so important because in a way, all Buddhist teachings are pointing to this. This sort of primordial experience of human beings, if we will allow it, if we will allow ourselves to come into contact with that which is not at peace. And then it gives it a voice, it recognizes that. In a world that would rather not, right? But I think if we allow, every human being knows this, and it can appear in many different ways, be articulated in different ways, certainly be responded to in many different ways. You know, is it born in that first moment, whereas some early point in our life where we first encountered death, something dear to us dies? a family member, a friend, a pet, and we realize, oh, as the Buddha said, it's a messenger. I too am of the nature to pass from this life. And at that moment, our life takes on a very different perspective. It doesn't go on forever. It's finite. What is it for? As though if we were going to live forever, that question wouldn't matter, right? It would somehow be resolved. But it makes it very, it presses it up against us because we realize we don't actually have forever. That's why in training, there are so many ways in which the liturgy and practice is trying to bring forth that urgency. Let me respectfully, so we sing a bedtime song to you every night. A little lullaby, right? Let me respectfully remind you, time, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by. Opportunities are lost. I might think, I have the rest of my life to practice like this. In this body, with this good health, being able to sit in this posture, with this clarity of mind. What makes me think that? Because I want to believe it. Buddhism constantly reminds us, you don't know, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. Not to live in fear, but to live more truthfully. And now, knowing that, what do I give my attention to? What becomes important? Because in our time, you know, sort of our time and culture and society has sort of, you know, put some of its best energy and resources into helping us to ignore my mind is not yet at peace, to ridicule it, even turn it into a cliche, certainly to turn away from it or to numb from it so that we don't have to encounter that. We don't have to be uncomfortable. We don't have to be cast into doubt to want to know and not to know and not to know. My mind is not yet at peace, and what do I do? And that's where encountering a path can be like a gift. Oh, there's a way. There are people who have asked the same thing, felt the same thing, and have discovered something, and have traveled that path, and have resolve that. The Buddha called it a noble path, the Eightfold Path. And so we have all these practices, we have teachings, we have monasteries, we have the three treasures, we welcome babies into the world, we do funerals to pass people along, we live lives within this path. We cultivate compassion. We calm the mind. We walk this path, those of us who do, and this koan is pointing to the fundamental. Yes, all of that. Hweka was living his life in all of that. Bodhidharma turned him directly to the heart of the matter. Sadhu Roshi would say, the heart of being. Bring that mind to me. Your mind is not at peace. And if we have allowed ourselves to experience that, if we know that well, we know that mind that is not at peace. It's not just a mind, it's not just something in our head, it's in our whole being. Something is not at ease. Something is not settled. And that can be true in a life that is going along quite nicely. And good for that. Everything is fine, and something deep, something essential, something that you feel but can't quite touch, something that is not resolved but you can't fix it. It's not like that. And it can permeate our whole being. It can guide us. It can cause us to go seeking. It can help us to find a path. Master Dawei said, take that mind that is not at peace and put it on the tip of your nose so you don't forget. And so part of that is learning how to carry, how to hold and live with our lack of ease, right? And live a life and have joy and happiness and good relationships and meaningful work, so that we learn how to carry that. In a way, it's one of the charges, I think, something that we're charged with developing the capacity to do as practitioners, if we feel that within us, because what's the alternative? Shut it down or get lost in it, right? So that it really becomes an illness in a way, because we don't know how to hold it. And so that's part of what training is intended to do, right? To put us on our seat so that we stop, and then to keep you going, so we don't get mired, right? We don't get lost in fantasies and, you know, pleasure-seeking things, but we also don't get lost in our own not yet at peace. We don't get lost there either. How to hold that well. And so Bodhidharma says, bring that mind to me that you're clearly experiencing, feeling. It's there. It's in you. It's brought you here. You're asking to have that brought to peace. Bring it to me, Bodhidharma says. And so the koan doesn't say this. Koans are very often very condensed. But the student knowing this knows that Hueco went to his meditation and wanted more than anything else to find that mind. He wanted to do exactly what his teacher was asking him to do, to bring that mind to him. And so he sat and he searched and he searched and he searched, like his life depended on it. Master Linji said, you must right now turn your light around and shine it on yourself. Don't go seeking somewhere else. Then you will understand that in body and mind, you are no different from the ancestors and Buddhas, and there is nothing outside of you that you need to do. It cannot be found out there. And so how do we turn that light around? How do we see directly in the mind? How do you search for that mind? Only you can do this. Only the student can know this. We are given the ample tools within our meditation. So when we're first given instruction in Zazen, in a sense we could say, okay, that's pretty much it. Now it's up to you. But it takes time and practice and energy and support and teachings to actually discover, what did I just get? What did you just say? What is this? Because we're given it to us, it's given to us in a sense via what sounds like instructions. You bend your legs, you do this, you hold your hands in this way, you sit in this posture, you bring your mind to your breath. And that's true, that's what we do. We give instructions, that's necessary. But that is a doorway to doing what Linji says. Now turn the light around and shine it on yourself. Don't go anywhere. Whoa, that is hard. Because we want to go somewhere, like right now. An old master said, we just want to keep flying away, fly away, fly away, fly away. Only we can know. That's the bad news. We can't do it for you. And that's the good news. You don't have to wait. It's not coming from, no one's coming to save you. When that goes from being a disappointment to hallelujah, I don't have to wait. It's me. Hueco comes back and says, I have searched, and it's finally unattainable. he did not find something that was unattainable. There was only no finding. Saint Teresa said, these properties of humility and letting go of the self, she said, have the capacity to hide themselves. Hide themselves. And that's just a way of speaking. Huecas could not find his mind. Master Dogen calls it forgetting, a very profound forgetting. It's not something we can make happen. It's not something we can contrive. It comes directly out of a deep search, a deep questioning. And as I said before, you know, because everybody who comes to the Dharma and stays with it on any level can do that in all kinds of ways and can benefit in all kinds of ways. So it's really important to appreciate that. In a sense, we are here in all kinds of ways to respond to all kinds of seeking. And fundamentally, from the beginning, and I hope that never changes, we are here for those who are seeking the most fundamental sort of invitation, if you will. Not really a promise, but an invitation that started with the Buddha, which is we do not have to struggle. We do not have to be not yet at peace. That's not inevitable. It's not necessary. But we do need to practice if we want that to liberate ourselves. Master Dogen says, everyone without exception holds on to the jewel that glows in the night. We call that Buddha nature, or enlightened mind, Bodhi mind, that we already possess. But he said, unless we turn the light around and shine it within, how can we hold close this jewel when we are lost in the outlying countryside? When we are wandering. When we're lost in the countryside, how can we know? How can we hold that jewel close? In a sense, that's what practice is. That's what practitioners have to sort of develop the skill to do, is how do you hold that desire, that longing, the yearning, the motivation, whatever it is that inspires you to do your meditation, to study the Dharma, to be here, if not here, to continue searching, to find something that is worthy of your search and can respond to it. Because it can so easily get lost in the countryside. And the countryside is everywhere. It's in the city. It's at work. There's so many ways we can get lost. And so, in a sense, practitioners, we have to learn how to hold close, like on the tip of our nose. Which in a sense means to keep remembering what are the most important things. You know, how often when people are at the time of death and it's facing them and they're facing it, so many things that were very important for so many years, that were sort of the objects of so much devoted energy, aren't. Things can come into view very sharply at that time. And that's really what Buddhism is trying to do, is in a sense bring that poignancy, that aliveness of the preciousness of this human life. It's spoken of that way. And made precious when we realize, oh, I'm alive. And not just, whoopee, I get to have as much fun as I can. But rather, I have the opportunity to do something good. Something good. What prevents me from that? What holds me back from that? What limits me? What do I need to relinquish? Why does St. Teresa talk about humility? Why is that important? Why in our avoiding my mind is not yet at peace culture, is humility so scarce, so undervalued, so misunderstood as weakness or stupidity? What happens when such an essential virtue is held in cynicism? It's not good. An old Indian master said, when you look at the center of the sky, your very looking will cease. Likewise, when mind looks at mind, the swarms of thoughts cease and unsurpassable enlightenment is attained. I have searched for the mind and it is finally unattainable. And Bodhidharma said, there, finally, it is at rest. Coming from the West and directly pointing, this great affair was caused by the transmission. That's, in a sense, what has been passed down. The entanglements, right? The obstructions, dukkha, right? Holding up, pointing to it, and saying, yeah, this is it. In a sense, it's creating waves where there's no wind. Why? Because we already have Buddha nature. That's what I said to Ruben, that little chat we had this morning. You're already fine. You know that. We're fine. What's all the fuss? Why go to all this? So we can know it directly. The troublemaker who caused all of this is, after all, you. As the great John Lewis said, there's troublemaker, which is, you know, just creating all kinds of hell realms. And then there's good troublemaking. So I'll finish with a poem. So many times, so many times this tilting world every day traveled, hope can be all but lost. Encountering the ancient way, whose voice is this from deep within calling? Oh, you weaver of tangled webs, now that your face is seen, I will not be fooled again. The season of great peace has arrived. Thank you, those of you who've been with us this weekend. It was nice living and practicing with you. I hope this has been helpful. Please keep taking steps in whatever direction you may. Make sure that they are worthy of your efforts. And be wholehearted. That's something each of us can give.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.